In a world where fans have grown tired of the same old cookie-cutter Comic-Con formats, only one con defies the odds. Only one Comic-Con stands what fans really want. Only one Comic-Con dares calls itself terrific. That's right, this August 17th through the 19th at the all-new giant-sized Mohegan Sun Expo Center in Uncasville, Connecticut, comes Terrific-Con! Connecticut's Terrific Comic-Con is back with New England's largest gathering of comic book artists and writers. Plus, Terrific-Con delivers actors from your favorite TV shows and movies. And there's an all-new expanded gaming section as we give you tabletop gaming, video games, and so much more. Plus, don't forget, all kids 10 and under get in free at Terrific-Con and can be part of the all-new All Yeah Kids Comic-Con. Join us for 3 full days of Comic-Con action only in Connecticut at Terrific-Con. For more information, go to our website, www.terrificcon.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. John Suntris here. Wanted to start off by saying, first of all, there's going to be another episode dropping today, and that's an incredible conversation with the daughter of George Carlin, Kelly Carlin. There's a new box set of George Carlin's HBO specials, but even more exciting, part of the box set is going to be a bunch of previously unreleased video of George Carlin in his pre-hippie era. That's what I'm calling it. Back in his clean-cut early 60s persona, when he did a lot of variety shows like Ed Sullivan. There's even an NBC special that she mentions. And I cannot wait to watch a lot of this unreleased Carlin in a very interesting part of his career, his kind of straight-laced stand-up years. We talk about that period and the evolution of his comedy over the decades, starting from the 60s through the early 2000s, till his death, really. And just the transformations that Carlin made over the years and how a lot of his comedy still reflects today's culture wars. It's a great conversation. And also, I just wanted to thank the Word Balloon audience for listening and indulging me in these forks in the road that deviate from the usual nerd culture comic book fair that I talk about here on Word Balloon. It's very exciting for me to have these opportunities to talk to these people that are away from the comic book business but are still part of our pop culture. And you know me, I love my TV, I love my old movies, and I'm fascinated by 20th century pop culture. So these opportunities to talk to these people are just incredible, and I'm happy to share them with you, and I'm really glad that you're responding to that. So also today, Kelly Carlin talking about the legacy of her father, George Carlin, and how it impacts her, what she's doing today. It's a great hour-long conversation that I'm sharing with you in addition to today's Word Balloon that you're listening to right now, where I'm really excited to be also talking to Teenie Howard. Teenie Howard's a terrific writer, and I'm so glad to have found her work and finally have the opportunity to talk to her directly about it. She is a great writer. Assassinistas from IDW's Black Crown imprint is one of their best books. She and Gilbert Hernandez just doing a tremendous job exploring a team of assassins that were active back in the 90s, and now they're modern-day adventures as they've all split off. Some have children, all have personal problems, and it's a good combination of action and comedy in Assassinistas. Teenie has also taken over Hack Slash, Tim Seeley's excellent creation of Cassie Hack, the great monster hunter, and that's a great horror comedy series. I'm sure you're well aware of it, and really excited to witness Teenie's spin on the Hack Slash world and universe. And then also, she's doing incredible work on Rick and Morty. I love the show. I love the Oni comics. She is one of the strong writers, and she has done collaborations with other writers like Kyle Starks, but also Mark Ellerby has been her co-creator on this wonderful series. Pocket Like You Stole It is the trade that involves her Rick and Morty stories. Great stuff. I mean, if you love the show, just like The Simpsons comics. If you love The Simpsons, you love The Simpsons comics. It really reflects well on the TV series. The same goes with Teenie's work on Rick and Morty. So it's so fun to talk to Teenie Howard today on Word Balloon. It's all brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Thank you, League, for your support. You continue to help make the podcast go via your subscriptions through Patreon. Word Balloon is free. It'll always be free. But if you want to help out the cause, if you like what we do here and want to support the show, you can do that by subscribing to Word Balloon via Patreon. You can go to patreon.com/wordballoon, or you can just click on the Patreon ad on the front page of wordballoon.com. But as always, thank you very much for your support, League of Word Balloon listeners. Word Balloon is also brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. And there's some great Teenie Howard product waiting for you at InStock Trades. You can get her Magdalena Reformation trade paperback from Top Cow. We talk about this in the conversation. A really interesting story and a way to kind of expand Magdalena's origin story. It's great. It's 42% off, $9.85. Again, the aforementioned Rick and Morty Pocket Like You Stole It trade paperback. Very funny stuff from Teenie Howard. Mark Ellerby captures the look of Rick and Morty, and Teenie captures its voice. Very funny stuff. It's 30% off, $13.99. And you can get the first volume of Teenie's Hackslash Resurrection. It's Cassie, and the artist is called Celor, or Celor. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name or her name. Forgive me. But this is another great volume of Cassie Hack Hackslash stuff. And it is 42% off, $9.85. So some of the great Teenie Howard product you can get at InStock Trades. I can't wait because I know there's going to be more coming. But right now, there's a bunch of Teenie Howard product at great prices. You won't want to miss it, especially after you hear this conversation if you're new to Teenie's work. And I know Assassinistas, when it gets collected, will likely be there as well. But check out some of the great Teenie Howard product waiting for you at InStockTrades.com. All right, without further ado, let's get into our conversation with Teenie Howard. Really excited to talk to her about her start in comics and what she's doing now and the future as well. Teenie Howard on today's Word Balloon. Teenie Howard, welcome to Word Balloon. This is thrilling for me because ever since they announced Assassinistas, I'm like, oh, I got to talk to her. So,
oh, man.
So
well,
thanks thank for coming you. On. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's nice to be on here.
Oh, I'm really glad you know who I am. That's good.
I do. I actually, even before Shelley came on and said such nice things about me, I was familiar with your work, and I like the podcast a lot. So.
Oh, that's really nice. Thank you very much. Well, I like your work, and I really, like I said, when Assassinistas was described, I'm like, oh, I'm so in. And it's great. Really have enjoyed
thank
the first five
you.
Issues. And psyched for issue 6 and where things may be going. But yeah, no, from the start. And God, what an exciting thing to be able to work with Hernandez and everything. Tell me about
that. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, how did that happen?
Well, that was all Shelley Bond magic. I mean, and I can honestly, if I'm going to start by going back and being in shock that Legends were willing to work with me, it starts when Shelley called me. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, I can't talk about getting to work with Gilbert without getting to talk about working with Shelley because sure. She's really how that happened. And, you know, it was like, it couldn't have been better timing. Like, I mean, I was just at a part in my career where I was like, okay, I've done a couple good things and where do I go next? And I wanted to do... I had done The Skeptics at Black Mask kind of by the seat of my pants. And I was like, gosh, you know, the next time I do a creator owned book, I feel like I really need some guidance. I need, like a really good editor or a mentor or just someone who's going to really hold my hand through this because I felt like my first, creator owned experience was like a lot of people, you know, trial by fire. And it's very punk rock. I mean, that's, you know, and a lot of companies are like that, you know, Image, it's kind of the same thing, you know, you're expected to produce a book. And I, and Shelley, you know, reached out to me and like my brain fell out of the back of my head because I mean, I wouldn't be in comics today if it weren't for so many of the books that Shelley worked on and made possible through her time at Vertigo. So I was floored and more than happy to work with her on, you know, whatever, wherever she was going next and what she was up to. So, I happily wanted to work with her and we worked on ideas and Assassinistas was, one that I had wanted to make happen for a while. I had written a prose short story a few years ago that had kind of introduced the characters of Dominic and Octavia who are the leads. And I wanted to go back to them. I wanted to fill out the world that I had implied. And, Shelley was really into it and, you know, I wasn't sure what artist I wanted to work with yet. And for me, I can't work too much on a story until I know who my artist is going to be.
Sure.
I can, you know, plan it out in my head and stuff. But when it comes to actually writing the script, I need to know, you know, I can outline, but when I'm writing a script, I need to know who I'm writing for. And so I felt kind of stuck. You know, I wanted to do more on it, but I didn't have an artist settled yet. And Shelly just sent me an email that was like, what do you think about this? You know, Teenie Howard, Gilbert Hernandez, Zasnistas. And I was like, well, obviously I think that's amazing, but that's not going to happen. Like, I just wrote it off. I was like, that's cool. Maybe he'll do a cover. Like, sure. You know, the Hernandez brothers do not need to work on the scripts of any nobodies like me. You know, they don't need that. And Shelley was like, well, you know, he says he really likes it. And, you know, he said that to me too. And I guess I should believe him because he's a wonderful human being. But yeah. And so from there, you know, the second that, Gilbert said he was on it, the second she said that email, you know, that the whole book became clear in my head, exactly how I wanted it to look and what I wanted to do. And from there, it was really clear to me, you know, cause I was like, how do I make this book about family dynamics and not just a crime book where everyone's upset that they're not shooting each other. Sure. And the answer is you make it Love and Rockets, you know, you bring in an artist who absolutely nails interpersonal dynamics harder than anyone, really. And a literal legend, a literal Hall of Famer. So I was like, well, great. Now if he says no, I don't know who else is going to draw this book because now it's a Hernandez book in my mind. And thankfully he did. And it's been wonderful working with him. And I've gotten to know his whole family, wow. You know, not just his brother, but his wife and his daughter, who's an amazing creative in her own right. And, it's wonderful. I mean, the best part, I went out to San Diego for the first time last year for Comic-Con, and the best part was just Shelly and me and Gilbert and his family just hanging out and telling stories and talking. And he's wonderful to work with. You know, I write him little love letters at the beginning of every script that's like, I can't believe you're doing this with me.
Yeah, Jesus.
Well, but it's mind-blowing to me. And yeah.
So beyond, you know, obviously beyond drawing and stuff, is he kind of helping you co-plot and everything? I mean, like you said, you weren't sure how you're going to write until you know what kind of artist you have and everything. So yeah, how involved is he in sort of the co-plotting? Because it has that Love and Rockets flavor. And again, taking nothing away from you, because really, obviously, again, you came up with the concept and you wrote these characters, as you say, before in prose.
But so much of what I write in is because I know what Gilbert can do, you know. Okay. Like, it's like knowing with some artists, it's like I would have to focus on, you know, different things. Like, okay, so I like to use a lot of images in my scripts.
Okay. You send them actual images?
Yeah, I like to use a lot of images in my scripts just to be like, hey, this is kind of where I'm feeling. And, you know, with some artists, I might say, okay, well, I know they know what this kind of gun or this kind of equipment looks like, but let me send them this exact facial expression that I'm really feeling, you know? And with Beto, it's like the exact opposite. It's like, he's someone who I can just be like there's one line where it's like, you know, one character looks at another. And the way I describe it is like when they're doing something, when your friend is doing something stupid and you silently have to apologize for them. And that's like such a perfect, you know, that's something that I know he can nail. So it's like, I don't have to, that's something where it's like, I know he knows that and evokes that so well. And with such minimalism, that, you know, I do a lot of the plotting myself, but, you know, sure. For example, like the character of Kyler, the little boy, was originally in the series a lot less, but Shelly and I were just flirting. Shelly said to me, she goes, you know, he draws really cute babies. You got to put some cute kids and cute babies in this.
That's hilarious.
There were already kids and babies in the book by virtue of what they are. But I was like, yes. Yeah, you know, there'll be a few, you know, they feature in the story. But once I saw just how Gilbert draws Kyler, I was like, he has to be in like every issue. Like his crappy little face, like his shitty little face. He's just like bratty little face is so cute. And like, I love the way he draws like baby Dominic with like his big head and his big eyes, like poking out of the little carrier. That like, I had to add so much of that. And like Lazy Susan, the iguana, like there's just so much that I was like, he draws them so well. They it's like, it's less that he is involved in the co-plotting by him saying, this is what I do or don't want to draw. It's more just that like, I know what he draws well, and that influences what I put in. I mean, because I want to see him do those things so beautifully. But you know, there have been a few moments where, he's punk rock, and he lives in Vegas and in a place that's, you know, seen a lot of violence. And sometimes we've talked about like how we want to show, guns or violence in the book, because neither of us are really interested in glorifying gun violence. So it's been, that's an interesting thing we've had we've had conversations about, you know, it's like, well, what are we doing? Are we showing things in ways that we feel good about? Cause yeah, you know, he's punk rock. He's saying something with the work he does. And it's great too, to learn from that.
I can appreciate that. And also it's funny. I just talked to Will Dennis and Jim Williams and that Where We Live anthology mm-hmm. that came out about violence and stuff. And yeah, you know, actually that was in the back of my head in terms of the fact that this is a book about assassins coming at a time when, you know, violence really is kind of like this ish kind of subject and everything. And hey, man, I'm sure you are as well. The book has a great Tarantino feel. And I say that, you know, with the best intent of complimenting
yeah.
with the vibe that you're going for and everything. And I think, yeah, Gilbert is an excellent choice to convey this. And it just, I love how it's playing on all these different levels because it is very funny. And yeah, Kyler is a great example of a shitty little kid that's way too hopped up on sugar. And, you know, I love in that first issue when he's diving around and finds the knife, you know,
yeah,
that's such a little kid thing. And it's, yeah, it's great that these are moms that, you know, and I love that you're flashing backward and forward to when they were young and just getting into the business and stuff to also today trying to get back in it with the, hindrances of being a mom or being a working woman and all that entails and everything. It's hilarious.
Well, thank you. Yeah. And it was also really important to me to show that this is Dominic's view of his parents. You know, we're not just looking at, you know, the fact that people are old and once did different things. It's more the fact that, like, when we look at Dominic, it's like, you know, we all have to deal with the fact that our parents were people,
right.
You know, our people weren't just put on this earth to raise us, that they were kids, that they've made bad decisions, that they have regrets, that they have flaws. And like that moment when you realize that you're an adult and your parents are adults too, is like a really strange, like, moment, I think, that we don't see explored in media a whole lot. And that's a big part of Dominic's, you know, his experience in the book is the realization of, like, you know, there's the, you know, the obvious A plot. Do I do my mom's dirty work or not? But then there's the thing of it of, like, you know, he finds it really strange and embarrassing that his mom was into all this stuff. But then we have, like, Taylor, who's like, that's cool. Your mom's a badass. Your dad was hot, you know? And it's like, I feel like a lot of us have been there too, where it's like, oh, this is this embarrassing thing about my parents, and your friends are like, oh, this is fabulous. This is cool. You know, and at the same time, you know, Octavia is not always as accepting as she should be of, or she says she's accepting, maybe isn't, of, you know, Dominic's sexuality and other things like that. So it's meant to be a really complicated book, which is why I'm really happy to have Gilbert on it, because he can make things that are complicated in interpersonal relationships funny and heartwarming and sweet, even if there are guns and lizards.
Iguanas, exactly. What is it with iguanas, man? Help me out, because I think to The Simpsons and one of Marge's sisters, Jub-Jub or whatever.
Jub-Jub. I think that I'm a huge Simpsons fan, so I think that probably was my subconscious inspiration, but I haven't considered that until just now. Yeah, it was just like, I love lizards and snakes.
Cool.
Like, I really think that, like, if I ever wanted to get a dog, I would just get, like, a big lizard instead that I could, like, walk on a leash. I don't know. I think they're really funny, weird little creatures. Oh, and yeah. I think that there's also something, like, funny about an assassin wanting to be nurturing. And so she gets something that's, like, cold-blooded and alien. They also, like, live a really long – they don't live a really long time, but they live, like – they can live, like, 20 or 30 years. So
oh, that's
I wanted
cool. That's a great pet. Oh, my God. So
I wanted to have something that, like – I mean, not all of them do, obviously, in captivity. Some of them don't live that long. You know, Susan's an exception, but not an unnatural one.
Okay.
But, I wanted to have a pet that could still be around and could still be a connection to the past. And I figured this, like, weird cold-blooded dinosaur was a good, was a good choice. And that, and you know, that's just other Shelley brilliance, too, being like, you know, you should have something in this book that's like a you know, people like cute animals, people like cute babies. And sometimes I'm like, well, I don't know if that should go with the book. But then sometimes I'm like, no, that's absolutely correct. And this book needs an iguana. It's a long time.
I also love the roller rink because, and I remember either you talking about it in New York or Shelley telling me in our conversation. But yeah, that killed me. And, you know, it's funny, in Chicago, we just had, like, a really popular roller rink go down. And, you know, I work at the CBS news station, and we had a story about it. And all these parents are like, oh, man, it really sucks because, you know, it was a great place to take the kids and everything. And I just love that idea that while that's going on as well, that, you know, drug deals are happening and this guy's facilitating these assassins with this roller skate, the skating rink front and everything.
Yeah.
You know, that's awesome.
And that, like, the skating rink in a weird way becomes, like, this place where, you know, Octavia and Carlos come together over the years to talk about various things. Like, it's, like, the site of all of their, like, biggest, like, fight things are. Like, I think there are more flashback sequences at the roller rink than there are of them actually fighting and, like, killing bad guys, because I'm just more interested in writing that. But yeah, and it's like there's something, plus it was really, really fun to, you know, there's something kind of retro. They're kind of out of time. There's something that, like, in the past, the roller rink is crowded and busy and cool. And then in the modern days, it's like, it's kind of crappy. You go there to pick weapons.
Yeah.
There's a roller rink in the town where I live that, like, sometimes I want to go there, but sometimes I think they might be doing the same.
I remember you saying that in New York. I understand.
Yeah. Where I'm like, you know, but also it was really fun because we were like, let's do this, like, retro roller disco thing. And it's like, Beto is like, disco? Really? Like, he's such a punk. And we were like having so much fun making him draw disco.
That's awesome. That's fantastic. Seriously, I love the Black Crown books, and I hope they're reaching the intended audience because, you know, we all miss Shelley's voice. I mean, I'm with you on that. I think some of the best Vertigo books were her books. And this really needed to happen. And that's why when she announced the line, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then also this idea of, you know, pairing vets with, you know, people that are, you know, newer. And it's been a great collaboration, I think. I think Milligan's Kid Lobotomy is great. I got to read more. I'm really only reading that in Assassinistas right now. But, you know, in the back of the books, there's
Punk's Not Dead is amazing. I mean, not just saying that as someone that does Black Crown books, like, Punk's Not Dead is very, very good. I highly recommend it if you
all right, good to know. Absolutely. Well, again, and you know, we're getting good samples at the back of the books as well. But what kind of feedback are you getting on Assassinistas from the readers?
It's been great. I think one of my favorite stories that happened, that was feedback, was just a few weeks ago. I was at a convention. And one of the convention staff, you know, came up and picked up the first, you know, several copies and took them home or took them and then came back later that day and was like, hey, I read them already. I blew through them. They were great. I was like, thank you so much. And then he's like, well, I'm going home, you know, got my family at home. And he comes back the next day and he goes, so my wife doesn't really read comics, but this morning she was sitting at the table and she was feeding our 3-month-old. And she, you know, she's kind of stuck there for a little bit while she feeds the baby. And so she grabs issue one and flips through it, reads the whole thing. She said she slid it back, switched boobs, grabbed number two, and it's like, I like this. I feel seen. And I was like, perfect. That's the best feedback I could have possibly gotten is that she was reading it while breastfeeding.
Absolutely. Like, you need a photo of that for the letter page. That's fantastic.
Well, he said he was like, I was going to take a photo, but I figured she might not be. I was like, yeah, no. I feel like I trust your story without you having to, like, sneak photos of your breastfeeding wife so I can print them. That sounds like I'm usually not at my best when I'm eating breakfast, reading comics in the morning. I can't imagine that if I was feeding a toddler or a tiny baby, I would look any better. But yeah, I was like, I love feedback like that. I have a couple people who I've heard from a couple people, like, I don't read comics, but I like this. And that's always the best kind of feedback.
Absolutely.
You know, people who you usually ordinarily wouldn't pick up a comic picked it up because it reminds them of something they like, or because they saw a character that, you know, was a mom and maybe they're a mom, or they saw, you know, the women in the book that, you know, responded to them or made them feel included, or the male characters and flipped through them. And I like, this is good. I like this. And that makes me happy because, you know, to me, when I think of the comics that are most important to me, it's the comics that I, you know, I maybe picked up and I was like, oh, I'm not, I mean, being a young woman, I didn't go into comic shops a lot. I got my comics from libraries and bookstores, which is, I think, part of why I read so many, like, you know, non-superhero comics, was because that was kind of the audience for them. Superhero comics have always kind of been the realm of comic stores. And when I got older and I started going into comic stores, I started reading superhero comics and I love them now. But for a long time, I didn't. So to me, it's really important to make books that speak to people that aren't necessarily comic readers. And it's hard because when you're, you know, when you're doing the floppies on the shelf thing, when you're doing that first 6 months or a year where your book is just floppies on the shelf,
right,
and you're never going to sell Batman numbers with a book Assassinistas or Euthanauts. But you hope, and I'm really hoping, you know, Assassinistas comes out in trade this summer. And I'm really excited for that because I think that a lot of our readers are going to be the people who pick our book up at the library, who pick our book up at the bookstore, who pick our book up because they're looking for a paperback in the section of, you know, the books that they might feel, you know, like they're not, you know, into one type of comics or another. But I'm really excited to for the book to get into trade, because in this market, it's like you kind of accept that, you know, you're never going to sell Batman numbers with floppies. You just hope that you can get the book into trade and that you can reach the people that are really clamoring for it there. And that's what I want. I mean, because nothing feels better than people saying, I don't read comics, but I read this. I'm like, sure, please. You can read all my books.
No, that's awesome. And I understand. Now, I want to get into your early days and how you got into comics. But before we leave that, two things. One, the trade's coming out. Is it going to be the first six issues or the first five issues?
It'll be the first six issues.
Okay. So we have one more chapter to go.
Yeah. We have one more issue, and then it should be out in August, I believe.
Okay.
So it's put together. All six issues are done. You'll have issue six soon if you're a floppy reader.
Yeah.
And then the trade should be out very shortly. So hopefully, hopefully people will get to enjoy it then. But I've gotten to look over the compiled PDFs. And it's beautiful.
Cool.
Shelley and Philip and everybody at Black Crown has just put an amazing amount of work into making a really gorgeous book. And I can't wait to hold it in my hands. So
are you going to have back matter in the trade, or is that just for the floppies?
There's some extra stuff. I don't know if we're not doing quite the same back matter. We're reprinting some of it. The character designs, some of the covers,
cool,
some of the letters between, you know, Gilbert and I early on.
Oh, good.
Shelley's printing some of our script pages and some of our letters from early on when we started collaborating with little notations and stuff. So it's really cool. You'll get to see, because a lot of people ask, they say, what is it like? How do you write a script?
Sure. Absolutely.
An Eisner Hall of Famer for a legend. And I'm like, well, I write it just like everyone else, but with a lot of love letters in there. You know, I write it the same way I usually write a script. I talk to my artists a lot in my script. I talk to my letters. I talk to my colorists. Like, I like, you know, a lot of my scripts have me saying, you know, hey, so-and-so, you know, feel free to do this. Or, hey, so-and-so, like, that thing you did on this other issue, can we do that again here? You know, I enjoy the fact that the people I'm writing and working with are creatives in their own right. And I like to see what they do. So I do a lot of talking to them in my scripts and you know, being excited about what I know they bring to it as well. But when you're working with someone like Gilbert Hernandez, it's a lot of like, hi, oh my gosh, you're still here. You've drawn four of these books for me and you're going to keep drawing. I can't believe that.
is he going to continue? I mean, I know you're, I mean, what is the plan? You know, how often do you think you're going to be putting it out? Is it, I mean, it's been coming out monthly, obviously.
Sure.
Is this an ongoing, and is Gilbert going to be part of the ongoing?
Well, number six is the end of the story.
Okay.
There are other things I would write. I've joked about wanting to do, you know, like a one shot Lazy Susan adventure. I would love to like come back, you know, if the trade does well and if people are big fans, I would love to come back to the story again and do little things here or there. But, you know, Beto has his own books to get back to.
And
I've got a lot, you know, invested in Euthanauts right now. So,
okay.
But I would love to come back to the world and do more. But six is the end. You know, our Assassinistas trade will be, it's not a volume one for now. It's our story. But who knows, you know?
It's great, honestly. I think it's funny, and it you point out the great differences of a woman assassin versus men doing the job. And I love, I don't even want to spoil it if people haven't read it yet, but there's a nod to a Godfather scene that you put a very, I think, female spin on. And
which scene?
I don't want to spoil. Well, I'll tell you, and you'll tell me
offline. Yeah,
we'll edit this out. It's the bathroom where she reaches for the weapon in the tampon box. I thought was very Michael Corleone and the bathroom getting the gun.
Yeah, I'm a huge Godfather fan, so I was like, oh, which one?
Is there more Godfather in there that I'm not reading, picking up?
No. I mean, just in general, and that, you know, it influences a great film and a pretty good book, and it. it influences a lot of my writing. But yeah, no, it was fun to do things like that, to think of gadgets and items and things that to me are obvious, but maybe aren't, because a lot of the genre is very like defined and written by men.
Sure.
And like, you know, I obviously love Kill Bill. Obviously, it's one of my favorite films ever. I watched it again recently for the first time since writing Assassinistas, and I realized that like first scene between Brittany DeGrane and Beatrix Kiddo with like the school bus and the cereal while they're fighting is like so much of the aesthetic of Assassinistas was just beamed into my head from that scene.
Yep.
But a lot of it was because, you know, Kill Bill is amazing, but at the same time, I was like, I feel like there's a lot more that we could go into with these women about them being women that we're not, because the writer is male and I'm not a mother. So there's a lot even that I don't understand. A lot of Dominic's perceptions of Octavia have to do with my own perception of my mother and the mothers I know in my life.
Okay.
And the fact that as a woman in her mid-30s, I have a lot of thoughts about mothering and motherhood, even if I haven't done it myself, because you're kind of forced to. You know, yeah, there are things like that, like, you know, things that a lot of men might find mysterious or distasteful that women would just find as utilitarian in the same situation, like hiding a gun in a tampon box, or just like things that are like, well, obviously that's a place that no one would look because everyone would be either like grossed out by it or they wouldn't even think of it. Whereas like, you know, it's a place that a woman would be like, obviously I can hide this.
Right.
And no. In plain sight. And so just for me, it was like, as a woman writer, it was really fun to do that, to be like, when I did inject a lot of, you know, it's like, you know, and like often in action movies, you know, when guys, you know, get a shot off on the bad guy, they're like, you know, you won't get me, or, you know, you won't come after my family or anything anymore. And it's like, you know, there's a moment where one of the Assassinistas shoots someone and she's like, you felt up your last receptionist, you know. They're able to get out their own, like their own kind of, you know, because I like action movies, obviously, but there's a lot of that like impotent male rage. And it's like, well, it's fun to do that like impotent female rage too, right? Like that, like, you know, this is for every guy that ever, you know, put a hand on my leg when he was offering me a job. Like,
yeah, yeah. No, it's good stuff, Tini. Honestly, it's very, very
funny.
Great levels. And yeah, I can't recommend it enough. And like I said, that's why I was very anxious to talk to you, among your other books as well. Well, let's do the origin of Tini Howard. So,
okay.
Yeah, like, you know, and you started to say, obviously, that you got into comics through libraries and stuff like that. And forgive me, have you been writing prose for a long time alongside comics?
So I like writing short stories. My truth is that, like, I've written my whole life. I've written a lot of prose because it's just kind of what was there to write.
Sure.
I've written short stories. I've tried to write a couple books. There were long periods of my life where I was still writing, but the only stuff I was writing was just like fan fiction for fun, you know, like just,
what subjects of fan fiction?
Oh, well, in my teen years, I wrote a lot of like vampire chronicles, like Anne Rice.
Oh, hilarious.
Fan fiction,
sure.
Right?
Yeah, of course. Why not?
Like, you know, Final Fantasy and books and video games and everything I read that I was into. And I would think, oh my God, well, I love this character, but they don't have a backstory. Or, oh my God, these characters totally should have kissed and didn't. Or, you know, just all that kind of fleshing out of characters. And so it's like I have a natural knack for coming up with stories. It's, you know, ultimately what I do when I'm left to my own devices is like disassociate and think about stuff. So for me, it's just been like a lifelong attempt at trying to put those thoughts into words.
Okay.
And like those story makes narrative stories out of these feelings and these emotions and these moments I want to convey. But I realized when I sat out and was like, okay, let's try to do something with this writing. Like I really like to write. Let's try to make something of it. I realized that, you know, when I've just reached for a book and I can choose any book in the world, I've always chosen graphic novels and sequential art. I've always chosen graphic novels and sequential art. Like, so, you know, no matter what the topic is, like if I would at the library or the bookstore, I would go to the graphic novel section and I wasn't even necessarily looking for books like Sandman or whatever. It's like, or books like Hellboy, you know, it was like, I would pick up if I could read, you know, Jane Eyre or the Marvel classic adaptation of Jane Eyre, I would rather read the comic one.
Okay.
So at some point I was like, well, why am I trying to write what I don't most love reading? And I, even though I had read all these books that were just written by authors without artists, I didn't know that that was possible. So, and I didn't actually really think about it. Even though I knew Neil Gaiman wasn't drawing Sandman, it didn't really occur to me until I read like Matt Fraction's Invincible Iron Man run, because I had just gotten into superhero comics after watching the first Iron Man movie. So I am one of the people that was brought into superhero comics by the movies.
That's cool.
By friends and my husband who were reading superhero comics and said, hey, you know, you should, you like this movie, you should try. And I was like, no, superhero comics are dumb. you know, they're not serious like the stuff I read. And he was like, I think that's crap and you should give it a try.
That's excellent. That's very cool. No, go on. Continue.
Yeah. So I was like, yeah, you know, so I read Invincible Iron Man and I had my mind blown and I was like, oh my God, superhero comics are really good. And I really like this one. And it's super serious and intense and personal to the character. So I started looking into, you know, who this Matt Fraction guy was. And I was like, wow, I really like his work, and he just writes it. He doesn't draw it. No crap. I didn't know you could do that. So from there, I was like, well, that's what I want to do. I want to write scripts for comic books because those are my favorite things to read. So I want them to be my favorite thing to write. And they are. They're by far my favorite thing to write.
So was the Black, and forgive me, the Black Mass title that you did, what was it again?
The Skeptics.
The Skeptics. Okay. Was that your first printed comic? Like, what were your earlier comics?
So my first comic that I, you know, had published was actually through Top Cow. They did their talent hunt, which was like, I think they did, they're, you know, part of Image, they did Witchblade and all that. Mm-hmm. So they had their talent hunt, which was to write for one of their like Top Cow universe characters. And there were some restrictions to it. You basically just had to follow the restrictions and write a compelling story. And I took my best shot at that. And it won. And I was really proud of it. So that was my first, from then it was like, okay, it was my first full length. It was kind of crazy too, because most of the time it's like your first printed comic is not also your first full length script. I'd written comic scripts, but, well, that's not true. I'd written full length scripts for my own stuff, but nothing that had ever gone anywhere.
Okay. What was the Top Cow character?
I chose Magdalena.
Oh,
sure. I later went on to co-write a Magdalena graphic novel with Ryan Cady and Christian Dabari called Magdalena Reformation.
Okay.
But that was my first attempt at writing Magdalena. It was like I got to write Sarah Pazzini, the old Witchblade character who I loved. It was like her she found this artifact and it had to do with Magdalena. And because I remember reading the Magdalena stories and I was like, you know, the earliest one they talk about is in like 16th century France. And I was like, well, wouldn't there be, if this goes back to the time of Christ, like, how did these artifacts get to Europe? And I was like, well, how did every holy artifact get to Europe? Through people stealing them through the Crusades. Sure. So I wrote like a post-Crusade story about this artifact just, you know, getting to Europe, because I'm kind of a history geek. So, and then from there, I was like, oh my gosh, now I have a printed comic in my hand. It has that Image eye on it. I can take it to people and say, I'm a real writer. And I did, and that didn't get me much of anywhere. But what got me much of anywhere was continuing to do anthologies and submitting to places and getting a lot of rejections. And, I designed the idea for Skeptics and brought it to Black Mask. And they liked it and they published it. And that was like, I was glad that I had done a couple things. Like I'd done a couple anthology pieces. I had done a couple things for Top Cow at that point, like one or two. And then got thrown into making my own creator-owned series, which was huge, hugely different. And I think a lot of people in comics come from that like punk rock ethos background where they've been making their own stuff. Well, like they've already made several comics by the time they get like a creator-owned series mm-hmm. picked up. And I had been in a completely different situation where every comic I had made from then had been like with an editor holding my hand. So it was like out of the frying pan and into the fire. But I'm very proud of the book. Like it was one of those books where it was so stressful that when I finished it, I was just like, I can't even look at it for a minute.
Wow. Okay.
And then when I looked at it again, you know, recently, I was like, I'm very, very proud of this book. Unfortunately, it's not available in trade yet. Oh. I'm hoping that Black Mask will print it at some point, but I think the single issues are still available.
As I say, so. And I'm sure Comixology, obviously, I'm sure digitally.
Yes.
Okay.
Digitally, it's available on Comixology and it's available, you know, comic shops can order the single issues. I think they can even be ordered on the Black Mask store. But it's not out in trade yet. We're hoping that cross some fingers that they'll release it when they can.
Well, I hope so. I would certainly think as your star ascends that, you know, they'll be smart and release it. That usually seems to be the way. I know Remender and Fraction, a lot of their early stuff and everything suddenly, you know, became back as they're, like I said, as their star rose. So, you know.
Yeah, I was joking about that. I was like, well, you're not really a comics writer if you don't have like a backlog of forgotten series that will someday be released. So,
but that's a great thing, honestly, because I mean, I know from reader experience myself, you know, you read stuff and go, well, wait a minute, let me go back and read the earlier stuff and see what that was.
Absolutely.
So certainly.
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's excellent. Well, and now I want to talk about Rick and Morty, because I am so late to the game on Rick and Morty. I literally only started watching it last fall during the third season because Dan Slott, not to name drop, but it's like, why aren't you watching this show? You would love this show. And of course I do. And it's brilliant. And again, shows your strength in humor, because the Oni books
absolutely.
The Oni books are great. And if
they are great.
And yeah, if people aren't, you know, people who are listening aren't reading the Oni comics, they're fantastic. And you know, you and Starks are, I think, a great team. And
I love that guy.
I knew his independent humor books as well. So at first I'm like, oh, that's cool that Kyle's doing Rick and Morty. And then I saw you're doing it after I had already started reading Assassinations. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Okay, great. And no, you guys have that in the same way that the Simpsons comics in the right hands are just as good as the episodes and stuff. No, I think you guys are hitting the mark with the Rick and Morty comics, definitely.
Yeah, I was a fan of the comics even before I started writing for them. So I watched the whole show. I like binge watched the whole show and was like, oh my God, this is like absolutely my sense of humor. And I think it was like the few weeks leading up to Emerald City. And I had a meeting scheduled with Ari, who was the editor on the Rick and Morty books at the time, just to talk about something else. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I remember I watched the whole show, and then my husband and I went to the comic shop that we just pick up books, and we saw there were like Rick and Morty trades, and he grabbed like the first two, and I was like, oh my God, I gotta read those and you're done. We like read those in 2 days, and I was like, I gotta work on these comics. And he was like, you should do it, you should ask for it. I was like, I don't know I'm not smart enough to write Rick and Morty. Like, it's funny, I feel like, I really believe that you have to be really smart to write dumb humor.
I agree. Yes.
Because it's like the whole, one of those rules of comedy is like, you don't write the first joke that comes to your head. You write like the second, the third, the fourth. And I was like, oh my God, but I'm obsessed. Like, because it was so many things I love, right? Like, I love, like, I grew up reading stacks and stacks of classic sci-fi, like Asimov and Bradbury. And so many of the episodes are based around these like sci-fi tropes that originated with like these old classic sci-fi stories.
Absolutely.
Or just like action movies and stuff like that. But I mean, in a lot of ways, a lot of the episodes are based around like subverting a sci-fi trope, and it's just very bleak humor, which I love. And I think there's kind of a heartfelt message there, even the idea of like, well, if nothing matters, then the only thing that matters are like the things that make you happy and the people you love.
Yep.
So, that being said, I was like, I absolutely want to write so many stupid jokes. I asked Ari if I could pitch, and I got to pitch, and I kind of jokingly called my story Pocket Like You Stole It, and then they kept that name, which I love. It's like one of my favorite titles I've ever come up with, and I totally thought they were going to be like, nice try, Howard, but nope, that's the name of the book. Then again, the other one's called Little Poopy Superstar, so I guess that was okay. But yeah, it's been awesome working on those books. Like, just being a fan of a comic and then getting to be part of it is great. I'm really lucky. I know people joke about Rick and Morty fans being crazy, but I've had awesome interactions with the fans that have talked to me and come up to me. I've had people take pictures of me, bring me presents, have me sign birthday presents for people, have me sign all sorts of stuff, have me draw pictures for them. I've had people run up to my table in their Rick and Morty costumes, so excited to take pictures with me. And that's like, as someone who cosplayed for years when I went to comic cons and anime cons, that is like the coolest thing.
Sure. So. Who did you cosplay as?
Oh, all sorts. I cosplayed so many characters. Probably like some of the major ones I did were like Asajj Ventress from Star Wars.
Okay.
I liked cosplaying her a lot. And like, I cosplayed Spider-Woman.
Oh,
like,
great.
Jessica Drew Spider-Woman, and like Madame Hydra and Maria Hill, and just a bunch of random like dark haired Marvel chicks.
That's awesome. That's great.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And tell me about working with Starks, because yeah, I think, you know, I met Kyle on a panel. I moderated a panel at one of Tony Moore's Cincy Coms, and that's when I first met Kyle, and became aware of his work. And I think, yeah, his you know, individual stuff is amazing. And yeah, no, like I said, it was great to see you guys working together, because I think I'm a fan of both of yours. So that's really cool.
Oh yeah, I love Kyle's work. Sex Castle is such a great book. I keep telling him, I'm like, where's the Sex Castle Assassinistas crossover? Like,
totally. Oh my
like,
God.
Like, how badly do you want that? Right. Like, I want Shane to hang out with Octavia so much. No, I love Sex Castle a lot. Like, Kyle is an amazing writer. So it's really, really great to collaborate with him. And he, like, I mean, we joke that, like, he's Rick and Morty's stepdaddy and I'm Rick and Morty's cool aunt, because we're not their mommies and daddies. That's, you know, that's sure. Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland, but he's their stepdaddy and I'm their cool aunt. And we try to shepherd them into fun adventures. But yeah, Kyle, we do a ton of cons together and panels together, and it's always a blast. Like, he's a really, really smart, funny guy. And, you know, I just co-wrote 2 issues with him, and I just felt like out of breath trying to keep up with him. He's so funny, and he has so much of the visual humor, because he's an artist as well. Sure. He has so much visual humor, like, down pat. Like, he just comes up with great visual background jokes, whereas I'm, like, you know, a pure writer, so I'm very, like, dialogue-y, and I try to make good visual stuff in my comics, but I'm not thinking of it from the same perspective of someone who's, like, a visual humorist and who draws his own really great stories, like Kyle. So it's great. It's fun. I learn a lot working with him and trying to keep up with him. So I hope I get to keep working with him. I like it.
And are you, you said you're doing the backups. Is that on the current run, or is that coming up? What's going on?
It's starting with number 41.
Okay. God, they've already had 41 issues. Jesus. Wow.
Yeah. I'm doing the backups for the next 5.
Okay.
I believe, yeah. So it's fun. It's a little story we're doing, and it's Rick and Morty's adventures in the public domain.
Okay.
So
they meet Sherlock Holmes. They meet, like, people like
they
that.
They meet Sherlock Holmes and Tom Sawyer and Cthulhu. And,
I can only imagine. That's great.
Yeah.
That's like, fantastic.
Well, Ricky Tiki Tavi and Jane Eyre and all that. So it's basically just me taking all those years. I tried to be a prose writer and English writing major and just making fun of them mercilessly.
<That's>
putting
fantastic.
Them in microwaves.
Excellent. And then, you know, I'm really glad that you and Seeley found each other and you got to do some Hack Slash, because you know, I haven't, and forgive me, I haven't read it yet, but that's awesome that you got. I think your sensibilities fits the Hack Slash universe very comfortably.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel that way too. I really, really love Tim's work. I actually, the first time I talked to Tim was because when he was writing Grayson, I got asked to write an essay for a book that was compiling like academic essays about Dick Grayson for the 75th anniversary of Robin.
Oh, that's great.
So I wrote an essay about how I was, like, a longtime Dick Grayson fan who was really skeptical about Grayson, but then really loved the run, because I specifically felt like they used the character's sexuality and toxic masculinity in a lot of really clever ways to both tie the character to the people that he cares. Like, the whole thing was, you know, how they basically pulled the character away from his life and all these people he loves, but then they were very aware of that and they used it in a lot of really clever ways.
Totally.
So I sent Tim the essay just as, like, a thank you, because I think, you know, I was just like, hey, I think you're a really great writer. His Witchblade run is one of my favorites. I was a big Hack Slash fan.
Cool.
I was just like, Tim, I think you're a really great writer. I love your work. I wrote this essay about it. I wanted to share it with you and with Tom King, who was co-writing the book with him. And he really liked it, and we became friendly from then. And then he reached out to me. We just kept in touch, and he reached out to me to ask me to write Hack Slash, and I was like, I couldn't say yes fast enough. Like, I joke that I'm like, I love it. Like, I am Cassie. Like, it's such a great gig. You know, I'm working on issue 10 right now, and it's so much fun. I've gotten to write Vampirella. I've gotten to write just all these horror characters that I've, you know, and I wanted to homage in issue 7 that just came out. I got to kind of poke at the Warrens, who are, you know, the couple that's infamous from, like, The Conjuring and all those. It's a blast.
That's excellent. No, I've seen pictures of you with Tim and Tom King. So, you know, I knew obviously you guys were friends and everything. Oh, that's really cool. Oh, I meant to ask, now mentioning Dick Grayson and everything, I just had Dan Brereton on, and we were talking about the Thrill Killer books that he and Chaykin did with Dick Grayson and Barbara Gordon. And
yeah.
Stuff. Yeah. What do you think of that series?
I have a huge love for like Elseworlds and just like sure. weird interpretations of characters. And I think that's because I grew up like reading so much fan fiction, which makes does sense. A lot of like, let's take these characters and put them in space or put them at a coffee shop or whatever. Sure. So I love that stuff. So like, I have like so many of this, like Throwcolor. I have like Robin 3000 and like,
oh, that was great. Sure.
Yeah. Like Gotham by Gaslight, like all those Elseworlds books. I love that like Multiversity series that Grant Morrison yes. did. I'm a huge Morrison fan. And I love that idea of like these characters are archetypes and how do we explore their archetypes in different situations. So I mean, I have a deep love for the whack 90s and 2000s world of
yeah. So you know, I'd love to see you write Dick Grayson at some point. I hope that happens at some point.
I'd love to do that. I mean, it's funny. It's like when you like a character so much, it's a little intimidating because I'm like, you know, you feel like you've read every take on them possible and you're like, I don't know if I could. I always joke that I'm like, maybe I'd be better at writing Red Hood.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh, very interesting.
But yeah, it would be a lot of fun. There's a lot of characters I would love to write someday. And definitely, you know, some aspects of the Bat family are there. I would love to write Dick Grayson as Batman again. That was like one of my favorite. That Batman and Robin, Grant Morrison, and Frank Quitely series is like super.
Oh yeah,
well, super formative to me. One of my all-time faves. So
well, and again, as an older reader, I know that you know there's so many levels to Dick Grayson and his relationship not only to Batman but to the whole DC universe. That was one of the great things when I would talk to Jeff Johns. I mean, you know, Jeff got it where it's like everybody in the DC universe loves Dick Grayson because
yeah.
he's like the Batman that. Is, you know, personable and relatable. And it's interesting because I think it is more complicated. Like, you could say on the surface, being Batman's, you know, sidekick and ward didn't screw him up. But it's like, nah, that's not exactly right. Actually, there's a lot buried, in, you know, down in the psyche and stuff. And I agree with you. I think yeah. the Grayson series was able to explore what it's like when he is out in the cold as a spy would yeah. be and stuff. But yeah, go on. Yeah, tell me about your thoughts on all that.
Well, saying, you know, I love great duos. I love the like master student relationship and like sure. anything. I think that it's really cool. And I mean, there's, you know, that's definitely something I do like in Assassinistas even, you know, we see a lot of Dominic definitely. Being like, this is what it's like to grow up in the shadow of someone like that. And that's a lot of that is definitely born from feelings I have about like characters like Batman and Robin. And, you know, when I wrote Magdalena, a big thing was like Patience and Maya were in a lot of ways. We said they were like Bruce Wayne and Terry McGinnis from Batman Beyond.
Sure. Interesting.
That was like I really wanted to do like Batman Beyond, but I also really wanted to explore a master student relationship where the teacher was female. Because you just don't see enough of that,
agreed.
I think.
No, so, like, agreed.
You know, like, we made Patience and Magdalena. We made her. We didn't want to get rid of her because a lot of times in comics, it's like, oh, this woman is over 25. She disappears and she's never seen again. And I hate that. Yeah, so, like, yeah. you know, I wanted to make Patience a teacher. I wanted to make, you know, I wanted to make Octavia, you know, someone that is looked up to and is a master. And then, you know, in Assassinistas, not to spoil anything, but there's... also a character who views Blood Diamond as her master and teacher
yep.
And is a completely different kind of person. So there are reasons for that, you know, in the text, but I really love that. I really love the idea of putting anything with a master student relationship in comics. And it's definitely tied to my love for Batman and Robin, my huge fandom of those characters. And, you know, if you're a, you know, every person talks about how different the, you know, the Robins are. And I think that those are all great examples of how just changing one aspect of a person or a relationship or their past can completely change who they were. And superhero comics do so much of that. You know, everyone's had their own interpretation of what if the death of Batman's parents went differently or what if this person wasn't here? I mean, Marvel does the whole what if series. It's just about what if this one thing changed
sure.
and how would it change the whole world? And I think with interpersonal relationships, that's a huge thing as well. You know, if one moment in that relationship changes or never happens, how does it change the people and the characters? And, you know, there's even, I mean, I even put a character in the upcoming Hexosh issues who's like an older woman who is like a, not so much a mentor, but like, you know, just an older woman, because I just like to have women in comics that aren't 25.
I understand.
I think it's important to not, you know, to not forget that.
No, agreed. And, you know, yeah. I was mad when, and I know that eventually they're coming back, but I thought the JSA comic that Johnson, James Robinson, and all those guys did was a great way to show older heroes mentoring. And and I mean, hearing you talk, I'd love to see like Wonder Woman really have a great adventure with Donna Troy and Cassie. And is it Cassie that's
Cassie stands right? Yeah,
that's Wonder Girl. All right, I want to make sure I'm getting my Cassie straight. Mm-hmm. See Wonder Woman more as a mentor to Donna and to Wonder Girl, and I don't know if that's happened that much.
Or if she isn't, to explore that absence and to deal with that feeling of maybe like, why was I here and you weren't here for me?
All good.
Like,
yeah,
you know, that's another thing too, is like to explore. There are things, I think one of the things when it comes to like, especially superhero comics and things where it feels like every event has been explored 10 ways. I really like to explore the absence of things. You know, understood. If there's a time where a character's gone for 20 years, it's like that might affect the people that knew them and loved them. Were they a part of that person's life or not? You know, I mean, especially, I mean, I'm not saying anything new here that, you know, people like, you know, Tom King and Mitch Gerrard aren't saying on like Mr. Miracle, like that book is doing amazing meta things about being present and not being present.
Yep.
And what that means. And I don't know. I like,
sure.
I for someone who writes a lot of very dumb, goofy comics, I get very philosophical about the origins behind them.
Well, like you said, I think there are story opportunities here. And yeah, I do hope that's a really good point, that the post 25 female hero is really kind of not explored. And there's,
yeah.
And with the different generations, I mean, God, you know, Mademoiselle from the original, wasn't she like one of the original Suicide Squad people? And if not, you know, I know she was in DC War books and stuff. I mean, there are right. great characters that they can pick. You can pick from the Silver and Bronze Age and really bring back and explore them as older heroes. Why not?
Or creating new ones. Well, that too. You know, making like, you know, we see Octavia as a young woman, but in the, you know, we know that that's the past. Like in Assassinations, mm-hmm. it's like these women are, you know, they're the mothers of adult children. Like a big inspiration for that with me is Sarah Connor and John Connor. Good call. That I love Sarah Connor, and I always grew up wanting to see a movie where like they were adults kicking ass together. And I really wanted Terminator Salvation to be that. And it wasn't. Yeah. And I was so mad. All I ever wanted was like, if John is the leader and not Sarah, why?
Good call.
Like,
yeah.
Does something happen to her? Or like, is he just the leader? And it's like, it's because he's the boy. It's because he's the chosen boy, and it was written by boys. And his mom's job is to bring him into the world. And the fact that she's a badass is just like secondary. And I hate that. Like, I love Terminator, but I hate that. So I was like, well, why not? Like, why? I was always like, I could do a lot with a Terminator.
It sounds like it. Well, Teeny, all right, let me ask you my, and truly, dumb middle-aged white guy as I raise my hand, but I usually ask this of Kelly Sue DeConnick, who I love and is like my little sister, just from an age standpoint.
I love her too. I love her very much.
Yeah, she's fantastic. Do you think
she's been there for me in my career since long before I had one?
That's wonderful, so. And it's not surprising because I know she's that kind of person. Do you think it's getting better in terms of opportunities for women to jump in and write?
Okay, so I think that we're all at a phase right now where a lot of us want to make it better. I think there are a lot of people who are super loud on the internet right now. Like, if you're like, you know, there's really frustrating stuff going on in comics. Sure. There's really frustrating stuff going on in the Star Wars fandom. I'll say as an able-bodied white woman, I have it a lot easier than a lot of people. I think that it's getting better. I think it needs to get a lot better.
Sure. Yeah, I'm not saying we're done. We'll always solve that problem.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's move on.
For sure. No, there are a couple big things that I think need to happen. I think we obviously need to start reaching out more to women to write outside their perspective, allowing
absolutely,
and also, especially when we're hiring like women of color or like disabled women or queer women, sure. Like we need to make sure that it's like, you know, we're not hiring you specifically to write that. Early in my career, I was sometimes reached out to be asked to write properties that just obviously weren't something I enjoyed. I would have people ask me for a pitch, and I think they expected, you know, what I will, for lack of a better word, call a girl book. I like plenty of girl books. I'm a girl. There's nothing wrong with girl books, but I think that that's what they want. I think that they're in their mind, it was like, we need a girly book. And I would pitch like something like Skeptics. And some people would be like, well, we were hoping you would send us something pink with magical girls because we want to sell to girls. So I feel like a lot of companies have their plan in place, but their plan is flawed. And I think it's because a lot of those plans are made by people in charge who are still not as diverse as they should be.
Okay. And I understand.
Yeah. So I think, we're definitely... And I think a big thing is that the direct market is so far from the only way that people are reaching comics these days. And I think, people like, Raina Telgemeier absolutely dominating the industry right now is great. I don't write a ton of young adult stuff. It's just not what I write. But I'm really hoping that those people who are reading Raina's books now are going to find my books in a few years.
Yes.
I want to be there for them, and I want them to feel represented and happy, and but at the same time to feel like they're getting good work I think a big thing though is like reaching out to I'll feel like things are a lot better when one of the big two announces their lineup of their next five big superhero number ones and three of the writers are women.
I hear you.
Like that's when I'll start to maybe feel a little better. There's this famous, I think it was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Someone was like, would you feel better if the Supreme Court was half women? And she was like, the Supreme Court has been all men so many times. Why can't the Supreme Court be all women?
Sure.
And it like blew people's minds. And it's like, well, absolutely. I'm like, look, like I've seen a lot of announcements where every writer and artist was male, or there was like the one woman that was like, okay, well, we got a girl so we can sleep. And it's like, I want to feel like me writing, Batman or Iron Man is not out of the realm of possibility.
I hear you.
And I don't necessarily feel like it's out of the realm of possibility.
I completely agree with you.
More importantly, I want it to not just be, I'm not just saying that for me and for myself and for my career. I want to feel like, I want it to not be, out of the realm of possibility.
Like a stunt or something out of the ordinary. I'm with you.
Yeah. If I'm asked to write a big name character and if I have to do a pitch off, then I'm also pitching against women of various backgrounds and people who my input is not just the token female input because my experience is not just the sole female experience. And it's absolutely, far from being representative to all the women that are reading comics and sharing comics and enjoying them.
Well, I agree. And I think, again, good work can't be ignored. And I think, things are getting better. And, of course, we're nowhere near done. It's just getting started. And let's hope that as I'm sure you already know, don't let the idiots on social media fuck you up it's the truth. I mean, seriously, because those assholes have always been there and now they've got a little platform, but fuck them. And there's at the end of the day, they're doing it. Let them make their own comics. Fine. Go make your own comics.
Yeah.
Good for you. That's okay.
I mean, like,
there's room for everything. And that's my point is like, why are you so pissed off? There's room for everything.
Right. Like I'm such a picky reader. Like I will buy a book, read 10 pages and set it down and never pick it up again if it just doesn't grab me. And I encourage that because I think that I feel like I have a really unique creative perspective. I really like the work I make. I really feel like I'm saying good things. And I want everyone to feel that way when they're making art. But I think part of how we get there is by being picky and by being critical.
Sure.
Which I encourage. I encourage people to be picky, to be critical, make your own art. But it's like at the point where you are brigading and harming and seeking people out because of who they are and not what they do. And then trying to hide it behind that, it's like we all know.
Yeah.
Like it's not a secret that, when people choose to go after people, they often choose to go after the most vulnerable and the most marginalized. And, we see that, but that's fine. Like I don't mind it because, I'm doing the work of my dreams right now.
Excellent.
So I'm happy.
Good.
I'm happy to, when I'm not working or playing video games, to go outside and play in my garden and think of more story ideas and support and lift up the voices and the people I believe in and the people that I don't, I am content with condemning them to silence.
Atta girl. Very cool. Well, now tell me about this this new Black Crown series that you're getting started in July.
So, Yeah, it's with Nick Robles is my co-creator. He just did Alien Bounty Hunter for Vault. He's a brilliant, incredible artist. He's self-taught. He's like, if you're a fan of like, I looking at his layouts on Ethanauts, all I have to tell people is like, if you're a fan of like J.H. Williams' work on Batwoman Elegy, you're going to want to pick up everything Nick's ever done, because he is a layout master. He is absolutely brilliant. The book is, I should tell you what the book's about before I just talk about how much I love Nick. But so Euthanauts is about the people who can travel into the beyond to kind of explore what lies after death. It's not, though, a book about heaven or hell or ghosts. The way that the afterlife is explored is via, imagine it's like a formless void, like space. There's a big nothing out there, and most of us can't hack it out there, just like how if most of us tried to walk out our door into the blackness of space, we would just croak. Most people can't survive in the world after death for that reason, but some people who are basically able to prepare themselves for death in certain ways and maybe control the time and the hour of their death can form suits that allow them to explore the world after death. And so it's about our main character, Talia, and the people that she meets that can also do this and the different perspectives that they share on death. And she has a near-death experience that enables her to walk in this world and become part of, and she becomes a very important part of it to the woman named Mercy Wolf, who is a terminally ill scientist who has devoted her life to the study of death. So I'm very, very, it's the book I've written so far that feels the most like me. And a big part of that is that Nick's art is just so beautiful that he makes it me feel like the scripts I write are just better. Everything is just better realized by his hand. I couldn't be doing a book like this without an editor like Shelley, who, I mean, literally I can just get on the phone and ramble for hours about how I don't know what I'm doing. And she'll say, sure you do. I took notes while you were rambling. Here's what you're doing.
Oh, that's awesome. It doesn't surprise
she's
me.
it's incredible. You know, she's one of those editors where it's like, if I'm stuck, I don't dodge my editors anyway, but I know that some people get, it's like, oh, if I'm stuck and I need to get something in and I don't know what to do. Shelley is that editor that I can call and say, I'm stuck. Help me fix it. Like,
see, that's awesome. Like, yeah. You know, honestly, like she and Will Dennis and those people that came out of Vertigo and stuff, it's like, I like their books and I keep seeing their names on top of the book as editor, or at the bottom as editor, however the credits are delineated. But regardless, it's like, these are tastemakers that get it and are finding the right people to make this stuff. So that's great to hear that, you know, she can facilitate your ideas and help you when you're not even realizing what you're putting down. And she's like, no, I got the clarity. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's really, really helpful for someone like me who, is also kind of like, I mean, like Nick and I are both like self-taught.
Okay.
Like we both just kind of, you know, wanted to do something and figured out how to do it. And so like, because of that, I have a really kind of chaotic creative process, and having someone like Shelley, who can kind of, you know, loop a cord around my ankle and tether me to something so I don't float away, is really, really, really helpful. Her and I just work so, so well together, because I feel like a lot of the like creatives she's worked really well with are, you know, she works really well with, I think, people who are like, just, she's kind of a spitfire herself.
Totally.
Like her powers are editorial. Mm-hmm. And I'm just kind of this like crazy, like creative writer type who, has my own nonsense form of, organization and stuff, and having her to help me is great. Like she reads everything I write again and again and again, and is like, you know, and will just talk to me like a reader. Will just call me up and say, hey, I was thinking, I wonder why this character did this. Like, not to say, she doesn't tell me to change it. She doesn't tell me, she didn't like it. She'll say, you know, I wonder why this happened. I just found myself wondering as a reader, and I'll say, oh, well, you know, well, I know why that happened, because I'm the writer. She's like, okay, well, it's not clear to anyone else. And I'll say, oh, okay, well, I'll put that in. Like,
cool.
It's great. It never feels like she's directing my story, or even that it feels like the story exists in my head as a cloud, and she helps me to distill it as it needs to be, or collect it as it needs to be collected, and share it with the world in the way that best serves the story.
That's great. No, that's excellent. And really, I appreciate the differences in your writings as far as, you know, the different strengths and things that you're pulling, because again, you know, Rick and Morty, lots of humor and stuff, and there's always, you know, there's humor in Hackslash, and there's humor in Assassinistas as well, and I'm sure there will be in Euthanauts as well. No, this is very cool, man. I'm glad that you are getting the platform that you deserve, and are
thank you.
No question, absolutely. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up? I don't want to leave us hanging if there's something else to talk about.
I'm really excited for Euthanauts, and a lot of people I talk to about it are very excited for it. It's super, if you're like we've been telling it as Sandman meets Six Feet Under.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. If you're into like, it's also like, it's, if you're a Bowie fan, it's Space Oddity meets Black Star.
Oh, you had me at a low. All right. There you go.
Yeah. If you know, you're someone who's fascinated by like life after death, or you know, just the way we as people process death. I mean, the book's about death, spooky death book. I'm really excited for it. But you know, Black Crown is part of IDW, but you know, the previews book is 2 inches thick. So I always tell people, if you want the book, if you want to make sure that you get the book, please, please tell your local shop. You can buy books however you want, or you can pre-order it online, or you can read it on Comixology. But however you do it, like if you are a shop person and you tell your shop, thank you so much for just saying, hey, I want to read this book. Can you guys check it out, or maybe order a few for me? And tell people if you like it. And if you don't, tell people too, you know, be honest about it.
Well, and also I got to, because you threw the Bowie thing out there, I got to tell you, my previous job was at the classic album rock station in Chicago, and Black Star came out and then Bowie died. And even when it came out, before he died, and before we knew, at least I didn't know how sick he was when he was making it, I'm like, why aren't we playing this? This is David Bowie. We play all of his classic stuff. And this weenie of a program director is like, well, you know, we just stick with the hits. And, you know, this is new. I'm like, it's David Bowie. It's David Bowie, like you said. It kind of bookends Space Oddity. Why aren't we playing? This makes total sense.
And it's,
go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. And I recently wrote about it for a piece about Euthanauts. I was talking about how much the album Black Star almost caused Euthanauts to exist.
Wow.
Because it was like, I remember I was like up at like 4 a.m. when like it came out that he had died. And I'm like a huge lifelong Bowie fan. And I had been listening to Black Star because it had come out a few days before.
Yeah.
And I was just like absolutely shook for a week straight.
Yeah.
Because all I could think of was knowing you're going to die and making art about that.
Totally.
And I was like, well, I'm going to die. We're all going to die. Like, he just did it immediately. But like, that was really powerful to me. And so I was like, I want to make something about death, and maybe I'm not going to wait, cause none of us know how long we have. So I want to make my book about death now. But absolutely, like, you know, someone on Twitter said that whenever they see the Euthanauts cover, they hear Black Star in their head.
Oh, that's great. Like, oh my God.
That's wonderful. It's absolutely there. And, you know, there's the first issue is called Ground Control. Like, I mean, it's there's a lot. And working with Shelley, it's like Shelley is not an editor who's going to tell you to put less Bowie in anything. So.
I know.
There's a lot of Easter eggs and love. You know, even Indigo, one of the characters, is even this, you know, gorgeous skinny boy with bright red hair. And actually, Shelley and Nick, the artist, and I all got to go to the Mick Rock photography exhibit of David Bowie's photos.
Yeah.
When we were in Seattle together this year. And it was very, very cool. We took a lot of photos, and we, you know, it was really quiet. I highly encourage any creatives who are listening to go to a museum with your creative collaborators. It's really a great experience. Or go to an art exhibit or a gallery with your creative collaborators and just see what catches each other's eyes, and walk around and experience art together and talk about it, or go to a play together or something. Like, go experience art with the people you make art with and talk about it. It's really cool. It's something I want to do more often.
That's an excellent idea. That's fantastic. Good tip. I like it. And also, yeah, you know, again, Shelley, when I talked to her, as I'm sure you heard, we both come from college radio backgrounds and everything. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm like, if we knew each other in college, we would have been working at the station together. And just that same sensibility. And I know how important music is to her and how it, you know, informs her art. So that's, no, that's excellent. That makes me that much more excited for Euthanauts. That's wonderful. So,
well, thank you. Absolutely. Glad to hear.
Hey, pleasure talking to you. And please, let's do it again.
Pleasure talking to you as well. We will do it again. And, you know, you've been so kind, and it's been so fun to talk to you. Maybe I'll shoot an early Euthanauts PDF.
That'd be great. I certainly would love that. That'd be wonderful. But no, thank you. And seriously, keep up the great work. And everyone out there, Assassinistas, Rick and Morty, Euthanauts, go back and grab Skeptics. Don't wait for their trade. And keep up the great work, Teeny Howard. I like what I'm reading.
Thank you so much, John.
Nice conversation with Teeny Howard on today's Word Balloon. I hope you enjoyed it. Again, if you're itching for more fresh Word Balloon, don't forget, earlier this week I released an excellent two conversations, one with Will Dennis and one with J.H. Williams and Wendy Wright Williams, all involved with Where We Live, the incredible Las Vegas anthology that supports the victims and families of the Las Vegas shootings of last year. It's a tremendous anthology. The great thing about these anthologies is I think they're incredible artistic expressions, and as well as really a wonderful testament to the memories of the fallen of things like the Vegas shootings. I felt the same way about Our Love Is Real, the Orlando shootings anthology that Mark Andreyko helped spearhead with IDW. This is a great one that Image Comics have stepped up with, Where We Live. And two really great conversations with the masterful editor, Will Dennis, the incredible artist, J.H. Williams, Wendy Wright Williams, who manages J.H.'s career and is as much a partner in their marriage as she is in their comic business. And it's really great to talk to them, not only about Where We Live, but about the market today. And, you know, J.H. and Wendy talk a lot about the Vegas comic book scene. And Will has some great stories about Joe Kubert and Lieber Mayho and some of the other collaborators that he's worked with in the past and is currently working with today. So I hope you check that out. And then also another fork in the road as I welcome back comedian Phil Proctor, one of my comedy gurus from the Firesign Theater, an incredibly influential sketch comedy troupe from the mid-60s who continue to produce excellent work. And much like the Beatles, there's only two guys left. They were an incredible quartet, kind of the American Monty Python in a lot of ways. A lot of really interesting counterculture sketch comedy that started in the 60s and started on freeform radio, the internet of its day, FM radio, when there were no holds barred. And Phil has just had an incredible career, not only in audio sketch comedy, but also live performances, film, television. He's the drunken French monkey in Dr. Doolittle, Eddie Murphy's Dr. Doolittle. He is also in the Rugrats. He plays the Howard on the Rugrats. So if you're a big Rugrats fan, you've been enjoying Phil Proctor's work for the 14 years that he did working on the Rugrats TV shows and the movies as well. Just a slice of some of Phil Proctor's comedy. He has a brand new podcast called The Proctor Podcast, where he storytells about his incredible career. And this is a guy who really lived that 60s hippie experience and was right there. I mean, it was, you know, he was in his 20s and enjoying life and, you know, kind of really heavily involved with what was going on culturally in the 60s through the 2000s. And, you know, many, many showbiz friendships and great stories. He's an incredible storyteller, making films with Orson Welles, making television with people like Harry Anderson from Night Court, who we just lost this year. Great encounters with Phil Hartman. Some of the great stories that I share with Phil Proctor, he shares with me, really. And he's just a fun guy. So if you haven't listened to it yet, two more episodes that came out this week from Word Balloon. Let me preview what's coming up next week. First of all, I'll be talking soon with Scotty Young, not only about Fuck Fairyland. You know, it's called I Hate Fairyland for the clean version, but we all know the secret real title of it is Fuck Fairyland. And also excited about him starting off Deadpool. And, you know, he's had a great relationship with Marvel over the years, so it's really going to be interesting to hear what he's got in store for Deadpool in our conversation. Also, I hand the microphone to my friend Ed Cato, who just did a great convention and had the opportunity of interviewing on panel Don McGregor, one of the key creators in the history of Black Panther, and a very important creator, writer-wise, who also entered the creator-owned market in the formative 80s with things like Detectives, Inc., and a character called Sable that was an incredible character as well. Don is a great, great writer who I don't want time to forget. And I'm really excited to present this conversation with Don to you guys on Word Balloon and women. It's a great story about his career, and I'm glad to check in with Don. I'll be seeing Don at Terrificon, so please, you know, if you are in the area of Connecticut or New York, I hope you make the journey, and I get a chance to see you in August. And Don McGregor's going to be there, and a lot of other great past creators and also current creators. It's going to be a fantastic convention. I'm really excited to be involved with that, doing some panels as well. And a great sneak preview for Terrificon is to include this conversation that Ed did with Don McGregor. So I'm looking forward to sharing that with you next week on Word Balloon. Also, a couple great boxing conversations with two guys that are not only great boxing writers, but also great comic book fans, and also in the case of one who has contributed to comic books as well. Michael Cronenberg wrote the Batcave Companion for Two Morrows and has a massive love for Batman and comic books in general. It's my pleasure to welcome him to not only talk about that book, but also some projects that he's doing in the world of boxing magazines. Ringside Seat is a magazine that he is highly involved with, from a design standpoint and also a writing contribution standpoint. And another great voice from my past, Doug Fisher, who is currently the editor-in-chief of Ring Magazine, the Bible of boxing, as it's known. And it's great to talk to Doug about his love of comics. And we kind of reconnect because he's only a couple years younger than me. And during my years as a boxing journalist, we did cross paths. And it was very sweet that he remembered me and even remembers my writing. It's just like my sports radio broadcasting part of my career. I'm always really pleased that people remember, because it's been a few years. And man, I stopped writing about boxing in 2006, or I should say broadcasting about it in 2006. Hell, it was in the mid-90s that I stopped writing properly about boxing. But, I was a foot soldier beat reporter of boxing back then. And it's great to catch up with these guys about boxing. It excites me. And again, another fork in the road. So I appreciate your indulgence in letting me, enjoy these conversations. Word Balloon is my journey through the pop culture world. And boxing is a big part of my pop culture world. So it's nice to share these conversations with you. So just a couple of the great episodes that are coming in the days ahead here at Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening today. Brought to you by the League of Word Balloon listeners. Again, thank you, League, for your support. Also, Word Balloon brought to you by In Stock Trades at InStockTrades.com. Tremendous books at tremendous prices. Don't forget, your orders of $50 or more, you'll receive free shipping. You will find all the graphic novels you want at great prices at InStockTrades.com. Okay, until next time, if you want to reach me via email, contact me, john@wordballoon.com. Follow me on Twitter, @JohnWordBalloon. Or you can follow me on Facebook under my name, John Suntress, and the Word Balloon Network. Until next time, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2018.